Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello, everybody. This is Jim Dolan, your host on the RTC Weekly Download. There were not many science fiction programs on the air, despite the fact that the most famous radio show of them all was Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. So now here's the most popular sci-fi series of them all, X-1, and the episode's entitled Dr. Grimshaw's Sanatorium. It dates from July 14th, 1955.
Countdown for blast-off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of Astounding Science Fiction, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, Dr. Grimshaw's Sanatorium. What you will hear in the next half hour represents either a magnificent hoax or the true explanation of the famous Grimshaw Sanatorium scandal which made the headlines back in 1947. The manuscript upon which this account is based was removed by the New York State Police from a fountain pen cover found in the doorway to Dr. Grimshaw's study. We offer this manuscript as evidence only. Whether it is authentic or not, you must judge for yourselves.
My name is John Dougherty. I'm a graduate of Hamilton College, class of 34, member of Theta Alpha. I'm one of those fools who wanted some excitement in life, so instead of going into my father's shoe business, I became a private detective. These are facts. You can check them if you like. The rest of what I write here is so fantastic that I don't expect it to be believed. If anyone should find this manuscript and read it, all I ask is that you notify Miss Millicent Armbruster of 299 Wallace Avenue, Buffalo, that Johnny Dougherty is dead. On the evening of July 1st, Miss Armbruster and I were driving to a wedding. Not our own, although I wish it had been. It was Sunday, and in order to avoid traffic, I took the Old Mill Road, a single-lane dirt affair that runs past the Gowanda Cemetery.
Johnny, aren't you going too fast?
Not for this road. There isn't a thing around except some tombstones and...
Johnny, the gate to the cemetery.
Well, what about it?
That hearse, look out! Look out!
We skidded for about 20 feet and slammed into the back of the hearse. The two rear doors buckled and snapped open. It was a freak. A huge oak coffin with brass handles tipped up and began slowly to slide back toward us.
Oh, how horrible.
You stay right here, baby. You okay, Mac?
You don't pay much attention to speed limits, do you, Jack?
Now, look, let's not get hung up on who was right and who was wrong. I was going too fast and you were traveling without lights after dark.
Let's see your driver's license.
Right here.
Private eye, eh?
Now, if you don't mind, who does this joy wagon belong to?
Gowanda Funeral Service. It's being rented to Grimshaw.
Who?
Grimshaw from the private sanitarium.
Mind if I ask what you were doing after dark coming out of a cemetery with a wooden kimono?
We're moving one of Grimshaw's patients to a new grave.
They always travel like this?
Look, Hawkshaw, how about skipping the third degree and giving me a hand getting this box back in the wagon?
A pleasure. Better screw on that cover again. It's going to slide off.
Let's get it in the hearse first.
Okay, Junior, you get on that end.
Okay. You ready?
Yeah, lift.
Now just slide it.
Oh, brother, who's in there, King Kong?
Look out for the cover.
I told you that would happen. What's the guy's name, Junior?
Oh, why don't you ask him, Sherlock Holmes?
A real wise guy, huh? I've got half a mind to report this accident.
Yeah, well, go ahead. See where it gets you. Now, if you'll pardon me, I'll deliver the body.
Everything all right, Johnny?
Yeah, I thought so until a few seconds ago. Listen, Millie, can you sit here in the car for another 5 minutes?
Where are you going?
For a stroll through the cemetery.
Oh, Johnny, stop making jokes.
When we lifted that coffin back on the meat wagon, I got a good look inside it.
Ew.
Yeah, exactly how I felt. I figured we'd knock the stuffing out of the corpse, only I didn't expect the stuffing to be sand.
What?
Yes. That wasn't a body, that was a dummy stuffed with sand, a dummy with a wax face.
Johnny!
Which brings up an interesting question. Who's supposed to be in that box, and, just where is the dead man spending his time? Sometimes in my business, when things drop off, you have to go out and, dig up new clients. My next case was a gentleman named Harlan Ward Sr., a wealthy automobile manufacturer. I'd gotten his name off his son's tombstone.
Are you trying to tell me, Dorothy, that my son Harlan was never buried at Gowanus Cemetery?
Exactly, Mr. Ward.
But why?
Maybe if you'll tell me the circumstances surrounding your son's death, I can help answer that.
My son was a rather impetuous young man. Tall, good-looking. After his graduation from Princeton, he began drinking quite heavily. After he got into a couple of scrapes, we sent him to Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium in the hopes that he could be cured. While my wife and I were in Europe, we received word that he died, buried at Gowanus in our absence. Last week, my wife and I decided to have his body removed to the family vault here at Short Hills.
How'd your son die?
Suicide.
You never saw the body?
No. We couldn't get back from Europe in time. Now you tell me that his coffin contains a dummy. How do I know this whole thing isn't a plan to fleece me?
You don't. But you're a rich man, Mr. Ward, and you're perfectly willing to take a chance that I'm on the level and that your son may still be alive.
You sound very sure of yourself, Mr. Dalton.
My fee is a $2,000 retainer plus expenses.
What sort of expenses?
However much it costs to take the cure at Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium. Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium was just outside Gowanda. Most of the cases were nervous breakdowns and alcoholics. I committed myself as a dipso, and just to make it convincing, I stopped at 5 or 6 bars on the way over. I was interviewed by Grimshaw himself, a small man with a fringe of white hair.
You understand, Mr. Dorothy.
That's not my real name, of course, social reasons.
We understand. Our paid clientele is very select and our rates are very high.
You'll be paid in cash and in advance, Dr. Grimshaw. How long does a cure usually take?
That, of course, depends on the degree of alcoholism. This is my assistant, Dr. Voynoch.
How do you do?
How do you do?
We are accepting Mr. Dorothy as a patient. Better place him in the ward with Mr. K and Mr. Cakey. Mr. K is a long-term patient, Mr. Dorothy. A highly intelligent man, formerly a professor of plant pathology. Mr. Cakey suffers mild delusions. I think you'll find him rather amusing.
After about 3 days, my roommates Arthur Kay and Crakey got used to me. And we even began to play three-handed bridge. Kay was a chronic dope addict, an intelligent, sensitive man. Crakey was nothing but a clown. He kept a big black cat named the Professor, which he talked to as if it were human.
And so I said to her, "My dear Countess, if you don't like the company of my cat, then you don't like me." She looked at me as if I were insane. But, of course, the joke was on her because I was. Professor?
Meow.
The professor is very sociable. Excellent company.
Except when he kills birds and deposits them in your bed. He's nothing but a feline murderer as far as I'm concerned.
See? You have insulted him, Mr. K.
Come here, Professor. Let's make friends. How about giving me your paw?
Oh! Scratched me, you black devil.
You insulted him. You hurt his feelings.
Well, just keep him away from me.
It will be a pleasure. I would advise you not to insult him again.
Good afternoon and evening.
Is he always as nuts as that?
Ever since I've been here.
What's his problem?
Manic depressive. And a little paranoid, too.
How long have you been here, Arthur?
At Grimshaw's? 2 years. I left for a while, but I couldn't stay away from the junk, so I committed myself again.
Did you happen to know a patient here named Harlan Ward?
Why do you ask that? Did you know him?
I met him socially a few times. I understand he died here.
So the newspapers said. I wouldn't know.
Suicide, wasn't it?
Was it?
You're being pretty careful, aren't you?
Mr. Doherty, what would you say if I were to tell you that I don't believe Harlan Ward is dead?
What makes you so certain?
He used to share this room with us. He slept in the same bed you now use.
I see.
He was an alcoholic, doing quite well, too, from what I could observe. We all expected him to go home soon. Then one evening he had a violent fight with Crakey. Crakey accused him of snooping or something. Later that night, Grimshaw and Voyner took him out.
Where?
Where they take all the special treatment cases to the charity clinic. It's that small building on the other side of the stone wall. A few days later, we read about his death. Suicide, they said.
Just what makes you think he's still alive, Arthur?
This. About a month ago, I was in the garden next to the wall that separates us from the charity clinic. Suddenly, I thought I heard a sound, like a child whimpering. It stopped. And a moment later, this note came over the wall, wrapped around a stone.
What's it say?
Help me, for God's sake, Harlan Ward.
Arthur, how would you like to have some fun?
Like what?
Like sneaking out tonight and going over the wall to the charity ward? What do you say? It would break the monotony a little.
I suppose there's no real harm in it.
Of course not. I'd go alone, but I'll need help scaling the wall. Will you do it?
All right. I'll go with you.
Up. All clear. Give me your hand and I'll lift you. Be careful when you drop. Ready?
Go ahead.
There's a charity building over there. The one with the lights in the basement window.
Come on. Let's crawl over. Maybe we can see something. Shh, shh. Listen. Can you make out what he's saying?
No, I can barely hear. Good Lord.
What was that?
Probably some patient having the DTs.
Let's have a look. Easy, it wouldn't do to get caught now.
See anything?
It's some sort of laboratory. I can see Grimshaw and Voyne and something else. What? There's a child with its back toward me.
Now take it quietly. It will be easier.
Please, don't!
It will all be over soon. You won't remember anything.
No, I don't want to go!
Voyne, give it to him.
No, no!
Shut him up, Voyne! No.
Good Lord. What was it? What did he do to that child? Arthur, that wasn't a child. It was a midget. The smallest midget I've ever seen.
What were they doing?
Trying to give it some sort of injection. When it resisted, Buena knocked it out.
What do you suppose they were doing to it?
I don't know, Arthur. All I know is that when it fell, it had the face of Harlan Ward. All the way back to our room, my brain was working like some frantic pinball machine. Only the score somehow wouldn't add up. The pieces were there, all right. A crazy old doctor, a brutal assistant, a private sanitarium, and a midget with a dead man's face. I thought that when I got back to our room, I'd have some time to think about it. I'd forgotten about our friend, the happiness boy, Count Crakey.
Oh, I caught you.
Fine, you've caught us. Now how about crawling back into the woodwork like a good little count?
Where were you?
Mink hunting. Arthur and I like to go mink hunting at night.
You make fun of Count Crakey? I shall report you to Dr. Voyner.
You'd better not if you know what's good for you.
So,
You threaten me. Me, Count Crakey. I shall scream for help. Help! Help!
Did you hurt him?
Just knocked him out.
What do we do now?
Put him to bed. Hope that when he wakes up in the morning, he's forgotten the whole thing.
And if he hasn't?
He's too crazy for them to take seriously anyway. Come on, let's get him back into bed. I went to sleep in my own room. And the next thing I felt was the sharp jab of the hypodermic needle in my left arm.
Hold it.
It'll be useless to struggle, Mr. Dorothy. In a moment, your motor nerves will be completely paralyzed.
What's this about, Grimshaw?
I might ask the same of you. My good friend Count Crakey informs me you and Mr. K decided to do some snooping earlier tonight. He followed you and saw you climb the wall.
Crakey's insane.
Mr. Dorothy, that is a matter of opinion.
Crakey, what is this?
Perhaps my assistant, Dr. Grimshaw, would be good enough to explain.
Assistant?
Yes. You see, I am the actual head of the Grimshaw Sanatorium.
Count Crakey feigns many delusions, Mr. Dorothy. But in this case, he is telling the truth. Count Crakey is actually Professor Ernst Hassler. Professor Hassler and I worked together in the Berlin Neurological Institute before and during the last war.
Unfortunately, my political affiliations with the Third Reich were under investigation by the War Crimes Commission. However, Dr. Grimshaw managed to smuggle me into this country, where I masqueraded as a mental patient in order that we might continue certain experiments which were interrupted by the American Army.
I can imagine the sort of experiments you conducted.
You and your friend Mr. K will discover their exact nature very shortly, Mr. Dorothy. It is a magnificent opportunity to serve science.
I passed out. And the next thing I knew, I was coming to in a different room. And hearing the voices of Voyner, Grimshaw, and Crakey, as if from a great distance.
Pituitrin.
Pituitrin.
4 cc's.
4 cc's.
How are the measurements?
Reducing rapidly.
We'll operate at once. Have Voyner start the anesthesia.
Very well, Doctor. Come back.
When I came to again, I had a blinding headache. I began to wonder if Crakey and Grimshaw weren't doing something to drive me insane, because I lost all sense of perspective. The room seemed to grow in size. I don't know how much time passed, but one day Crakey came into the room with a bundle in his arms about the size of a newborn baby. The bundle was my friend, Arthur Kay. And worse yet, I was exactly the same size that he was.
Let me out of here. Let me out.
Allow me to congratulate you, gentlemen. How are you feeling?
You dirty monster.
I'm disappointed, gentlemen. Do you not feel privileged to be a part of an experiment that will place me at the very top rank of the world's endocrinologists?
What are you doing to us, you madman?
It has long been established, gentlemen, that dwarfism and giantism result from injury to or malfunction of the pituitary and thyroid glands. The interlock between these glands was thought to be a hormone. I have discovered that this was incorrect. It was an enzyme. An enzyme I isolated some years ago. I was well on the way to synthesis in Germany when the surrender interrupted me. The interruption also limited the number and type of subjects on whom I could experiment. I was forced to find others.
Such as Harlan Ward?
Mr. Ward was only a control experiment.
I suppose you plan the same for us.
No, gentlemen. For you, I have reserved a special privilege. You, gentlemen, will be the first to test the full effects of the enzyme. In short, I intend that you, Mr. Kay, and you, Mr. Doherty, when the experiment is completed, will emerge as perfectly healthy, normal individuals. Except, of course, that you will be only 5 inches tall.
Days and nights that followed were a living nightmare. A nightmare from which Arthur and I awoke for brief periods to find ourselves in a strange new world. A huge, frightening world where everything seemed enlarged 100 times. When we finally emerged, we found ourselves imprisoned in a tiny mouse cage. Judging by the relative size of things, We could not have been more than 5 inches tall. Now we realized the experiment was at an end. That from now on, it was either escape or be destroyed.
How's it coming, Arthur? Another moment. I think I'll have this lock worked loose. And if we escape, then what? We'll worry about that after we get out of this mouse cage. Suppose we don't make it. At least you've written the story on that scrap of paper. Someone may find it and read it. Nobody will believe it. Then why did you bother to write it? I don't know. I suppose I want the world to know what happened to me. That does it. Help me push the door open. Now what? The first job is getting down to the floor. I think we can make it by sliding down the telephone cord. Are you game? Go ahead. I'm right behind you. Easy now. Look out! That does it. Now, if we can figure out a way to get out of the room, well, that should be... Uh-oh. Listen. Somebody's coming. It must be Crakey. We've got to hide.
Here. The grate in the fireplace.
He'll kill us if he finds us. Be quiet.
Well, my friends, time for feeding. I trust that you... So, you have managed to break out. It won't do, you know. There is no way you could have gotten out of the room with the door and window locked. I know you are in here. I would advise you to save yourselves trouble and give up. Very well, my tiny friends. If you prefer to play the game of cat and mouse, then I shall be happy to furnish the cat. There is no way you can get out.
What now? He's gone for the cat. If that monster ever gets in here, we're goners. There must be... Wait a minute. What? Do you see that thin strand of wire running along the molding? What about it? It's the automatic fire alarm. When the alarm is tripped by a fire or short circuit, all the locks are sprung. So that the patients can escape from their rooms. If I can short that wire before Crakey lets the cat into the building, let's go. There's a tiny sliver of steel from the cage on the floor. I'll work with that. You keep an ear to the door. Go ahead. This insulation is tough as rawhide. Blast this stuff. Hurry up, Arthur, for God's sake. There it is. Stand away. I'm going to short it. Ready? Okay. We made it. There goes the door. Let's make a run for it down the hall. If we can get to the garden, we've got a chance.
I smell smoke.
The short may have actually started the fire. Come on. Wait a minute. I have to go back. The manuscript.
Don't be a fool. There's no time. Come on.
You go ahead. I'll catch up.
Hurry up. I'll wait in the hall.
Only a second. I've got it. Come on. There's nothing to stop us now. Arthur? Where are you? It's funny. Arthur? Arthur? Arthur, what's happened to you?
This is the record found in a fountain pen cover in the burned-out hallway of Dr. Grimshaw's sanitarium. There's nothing to add, except that the fire which destroyed the sanitarium and killed so many of its occupants, including Dr. Grimshaw and Dr. Voyna, was definitely of incendiary nature. It is believed by the fire chief that some small creature, possibly a mouse, chewed the insulation off the wire and short-circuited the system. The two patients, John Doherty and Arthur Kay, vanished completely after the fire, and their remains were never found. Whether the manuscript which you have just heard is authentic, or whether it was the work of one of the more demented inmates of the sanitarium, we leave to your judgment.
Now here's another program debuting on the Radio Theater Channel, which you can hear on TuneIn. It's called Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator. The episode's entitled The Paper Bullets, from December 5th, 1951.
William Gargan stars as Barry Craig, Confidential Investigator.
The old saying, early to rise, folks, can't possibly mean a thing to a corpse.
Your Pontiac dealer presents William Gargan in another transcribed drama of mystery and adventure with America's number one detective, Barry Craig, confidential investigator.
Barry Craig speaking. The trick in continuing on as a confidential investigator is to keep on good terms with the police. Comes time for your license renewal, and a department sorehead can louse it up for you. Play footsie with a corpse, conceal evidence, rack up as many black marks as you must, but be sure you've got a friend somewhere in the higher echelons. High, say, like a lieutenant willing to countersign your renewal application, where it reads character references.
Ah, the fool that I am, Craig, endorsing your application.
Your signature goes down here, Trav. No blotting now. Right neat.
Certifying you as a man of good character. However will I atone for the perjury?
The guilt get too much for you. I can refer you to a high bridge.
Okay, I've signed. You're free to harass and otherwise misuse and abuse me for 12 more months.
I'm looking forward to it, chum. I'd start in right away if I had a case.
Oh, don't tell me the great man's idle.
One meal away from pawning my badge, unless you've got an idea.
I get the hint. Even if I could, why should I throw anything your way?
Because you hate seeing me fall dead from hunger. So what case did you have in mind?
Two cases. You even have a choice. Both of them prefer a confidential operative to official police methods, official notoriety. I was asked to recommend someone.
I'm all ears.
Case one. A Mrs. Cora Talbot wants help in finding her husband, Stanley Talbot. Talbot's been missing more than 6 years.
What's her motive in looking for him now?
Oh, a last-ditch search. She's about lost hope that he'll ever return. She wants to petition to have him declared legally dead so she can remarry. Interesting?
How big a fee?
$20 a day in expenses.
Kind of anemic.
It's all the lady can afford. Is it no?
What's my alternative?
A publisher named Hillary Grayson. He ran a best first novel contest, $50,000 to the winner.
And?
The prize-winning manuscript was stolen, very mysteriously.
What's it worth to Grayson to get the manuscript back?
A flat $2,000. So, which of the two has you seething with a desire to see justice done?
Well, I don't want to be mercenary.
Ah, then you'll accept Mrs. Cora Talbot. I'll call and tell her.
Call and tell publisher Grayson. It's not on account of the higher tab. The fact is, I've been a long time wanting to raise my cultural level. The publisher Grayson had more body than any one guy needed. Three sets of jowls and thick eyeglasses. Looking into his eyes was like watching fish in an aquarium bowl.
Get that manuscript back, Mr. Craig. Spare no effort or expense. If the manuscript isn't recovered, I'll be the jackass of the publishing world.
Hold on a minute, Grayson. You're forgetting I don't know what it's all about. I just got here.
Yes. I suppose I should give you the facts.
It would be helpful.
The prize-winning book manuscript, The Cry of the Hyena, by Eric Trent, was stolen right out of my office.
That's bad?
Catastrophic. It was the only copy in existence. The author has no carbon duplicate.
How come? Writers usually make copies.
Usual writers usually do. But this is no usual writer. This is Eric Trent. Yeah, here's his photograph.
I get what you mean by this one not being usual. Does he always wear chin whiskers?
Yes. Trent's a brilliant eccentric. A man who's roamed every corner of the world. A wanderer who wrote one page here, another page there. 6 years in the writing and more than 1,000 pages.
And no carbon. First prize was $50,000?
Yes.
Were there other awards?
One other. $5,000, a second prize.
Won by?
Oscar Sachs for his novel, Four Devils and a Midget. Oh, this is a photograph of Oscar Sachs.
Well, this one's clean-shaven. Can I talk out of turn, or are you the sensitive type?
Ask me whatever you like.
$55,000 in prize money. Isn't that a lot of cabbage for a...
For a small publisher?
Your offices haven't exactly got that mahogany and chromium look.
The prize money doesn't really come from me.
It doesn't?
An independent motion picture company, Pyramid Pictures. They pay the prizes in exchange for world rights to film the book. Any more questions?
Yes. How many offices are there in this suite?
Six. Why do you ask that?
I'm already in there pitching for you. That intercommunications box on your desk. Is every office equipped with one?
Yes, of course, but I don't...
The box is switched on, as you'll notice. It's been on through this whole talk we've just had. Who in the Grayson Publishing House would be interested in long-range eavesdropping?
I don't know.
Suppose I find out. But I didn't find out. The eavesdropper resented my curiosity with all his might. An inkwell pitched at me.
Ladies and gentlemen, have you driven a great new 1952 Pontiac? Until you do, you cannot possibly appreciate what Pontiac's dual-range performance really means. Only with your own hands on the wheel, your own foot on the accelerator of a Pontiac, can you know what it means to select with a flick of a finger exactly the power you want. Tremendous get-up-and-go in traffic, or smooth, easy-going, gas-saving cruising on the open road. The great new Pontiac gives you this kind of performance because Pontiac has, for the first time, combined the three essentials of top-flight performance in one great car. First, a terrific high-compression Pontiac engine. Second, the wonderful new General Motors dual-range hydromatic drive. Third, Pontiac's new high-performance economy axle. It's this great powertrain which makes dual-range performance, giving you exactly the power you want, when you want it, where you want it. Remember, only the new Pontiac has dual-range performance. Only your Pontiac dealer can show you this engineering masterpiece. Before you consider any new car, be sure you visit your nearest Pontiac dealer. See the new Pontiac. Drive it yourself. You won't be very many miles down the road before you heartily agree that dollar for dollar, you can't beat a Pontiac. And now, back to Barry Craig.
My eyes opened on Grayson, sprinkling water on me with a sponge.
You're all right.
Quit watering me. I'm not a petunia, Bed.
But you were unconscious.
I'm conscious now, and you're ruining my suit.
It's ruined anyhow, the ink from the inkwell.
Don't tell me. Red ink yet. My fee's gone up, Grayson.
Up?
$2,000 plus $49.75, the price of this suit. A while later, on the street outside the Grayson offices, a motorist tooted me over. A long hair driving a sky blue pink jalopy. I let him pick me up. You paging me, friend?
Yes, I'd like to talk to you.
What about?
If you'll get in, we can go somewhere. I'll buy you a drink.
Oh, buttermilk. There's a buttermilk bar over on 8th Avenue. In the buttermilk bar, we had a chat for the books.
I'm Oscar Sachs.
I know that. I saw the photograph of you in the Grayson Publishing offices.
Oh, well, there's some facts about the book contest I think you should know.
Why?
Why? You've been engaged by Mr. Grayson to locate Trent's missing manuscript.
What am I wearing, a sandwich sign?
I obtained the information through sources I cannot disclose.
Give me those facts.
I won the second prize of $5,000, but I was cheated.
Cheated out of the big money, is it?
Yes.
Explain, please.
The contest rules clearly specified that the award was to be made only to an American author.
And?
I have reason to believe Eric Trent is an Englishman, or anyhow other than an American. To put it bluntly, a fake who should be disqualified.
Disqualified while you're moved up to first place and $50,000?
Yes.
Let's have your bill of particulars.
Well, for one thing, Trent's way of talk. It's as English as the House of Parliament. Another thing, Trent was somewhere overseas on a tramp island in English possession when he sent the manuscript in.
That summarizes it?
Well, there's more. Trent has a tattoo on his right arm. I happened to get a good look at it. It's a tattoo of the British flag. Would an American wear the British flag on his arm?
They tell me Benedict Arnold did. You're really out to grab yourself 50 G's.
Well, why do you find that so odd, Craig?
Just that I thought artists had no money sense.
Well, I have, and I'm not apologizing for it.
Okay, I've got your point of view, Oscar. Oh, yes. One little thing remains. Hold out your hands.
Hold out
do
my...
Do what Papa asks. Red ink smudges on your right thumb. You've been playing with inkwells, Sonny.
Oh, Craig, I didn't mean...
Don't apologize. Fun's fun. And I like to play myself. My interest runs to sugar bowls.
Oh, Craig, no! No! Oh.
Eric Trent's address, furnished me by Grayson, was a rickety studio walk-up. Seventh Heaven in Bohemia, Greenwich Village. The door opened on a blonde who eyed you as if she was already counting your money.
Hiya.
Hello. This is 6D, isn't it?
That's what it says on the door.
It's my astigmatism. Is Eric Trent in?
No, but I am.
Baby, I'm not a gentleman caller.
So whose tough luck would you call it? Come in. Trent said for you to wait if you simply had to see him.
Trent expected me?
Yeah. That Mr. Grayson, the publisher, he phoned and said you might be over. You're Barry Craig, the detective, he said.
Barry Craig, confidential investigator.
I'm Judy. Judy Joy. Well, come on in. I won't bite you.
I was waiting for you to make that promise.
I live right next door in 6E. I come in here to play the radio. Mine's out of order.
Oh.
That's Bummy Fiegelspan's orchestra you're hearing.
Oh.
It's on every day this hour.
Mm-hmm.
I get simply dilapidated if I miss hearing Bummy.
Come again. Did you say dilapidated?
Yeah. Dilapidated, like frazzled. You know, fractured. Or were you correcting me on the words?
Oh, no, no.
Eric's always correcting me on the words. Imagine me keeping company with a real live author type.
Sure I can. I can even imagine 50,000 reasons.
Huh? What'd you say? Oh, there's Eric now. Eric?
Ah, Judy.
On the sofa's Barry Craig, the investigator. I've been keeping him here for you.
Thank you, Judy. Now, if you'll leave us alone.
Sure. I've got a slip to press anyhow. Nice meeting you, Mr. Craig.
I was floored myself.
Excuse me while I shut off the musical background. Now, Mr. Craig, the object of this visit?
Your stolen brainchild, what else?
But what can I do about it? I submitted it in good order. I'm not responsible for its disappearance.
How come only one copy? Why didn't you type up a carbon duplicate?
I have no patience with purely clerical details. I'm an artist.
But the full risk of losing the one copy.
I'm a man who takes risks, Craig. In my years abroad, away from America, I've lived a life of risks.
Skip the personal build-up.
Wherever I went, I traveled lightly. Suit on my back, pipe tobacco, and a pencil. It was enough of a nuisance carting one copy of 1,000 pages around. And how was I to know my confounded book would ever get to a publisher, much less win a prize?
Okay for that. What's your guess on the missing manuscript?
Grayson.
What motive?
A stunt. Grayson intends exploiting this whole affair for all the publicity he can wring out of it.
It's an angle. The 50,000. Would you say you won it legitimately?
Legitimately?
I mean, what if you were to be disqualified as the first prize winner? Say, on a technicality.
What technicality?
Not actually being of American origin, as the contest rules specify.
But I am an American.
With a British accent?
I spent years in the islands, in Jamaica and British Samaritan.
I'm told you have a tattoo of the British flag on your right arm.
So? Well, I sailed the seven seas, and like a sailor, I had myself decorated with tattoos.
But the British flag on an American citizen.
Ah, wait until I open my shirt. There. Are you looking at the tattoo on my chest, Mr. Craig?
Yeah, the American Eagle. What do you know? Expand your chest, genius.
Expand my...
I want to see old Baldy flap his wings. The first break in the case developed over the phone. I was in my office, soaking my feet. Barry Craig speaking.
Hey, this is Grayson.
What gives?
It's about the stolen manuscript. Listen carefully.
Shoot.
A hoodlum named Mike Kelsey got in touch with me. He admitted to stealing the manuscript.
Why did he?
A mistake, he says. He was under the impression that it was valuable. A rare manuscript.
Believe that.
He wants to return it now and no questions asked.
How much loot is he after?
$1,000.
It's paying ransom, compounding a felony.
I must have the manuscript back, Craig. I told him to negotiate the transfer through you. You're representing me in the matter.
Where's the $1,000?
I'm sending the money over to you in cash by messenger. You're to meet this Mike Kelsey in the tavern. The Flying Horse. Craig, be discreet.
Sure, I'll be discreet. The cash came by messenger, okay. And I got to negotiate in the Flying Horse Tavern. A mug with heavy artillery bulging his coat, waiting at a table for me. You Mike Kelsey?
No, I'm McGuire. I'm here for Mike. Hey, you're negotiating for Grayson, so I'm here negotiating for Mike Kelsey. Now, let's negotiate without any monkey business, Craig.
Why a gun under both armpits, Buster?
So as I don't develop a stoop on one side.
Oh.
Now, here's your manuscript. Right in the wrapping, Mike Kelsey found it in. Now, count me out a fast grand.
Here. $1,000. Count it yourself.
It seems okay. Don't be stupid enough to stop me from leaving.
Publisher Grayson was out. Would I please call later, a secretary told me. I'd gone back to my office to cool my heels for a while when the phone rang. Barry Craig speaking.
Craig, this is Oscar Sachs.
Now what's your beef?
Craig, I've discovered something I think you'll want to know.
Something that will promote you into the 50 G's?
Something that won't help Eric Trent any. Craig, the man's a fraud.
You're playing a cracked record, Junior.
Am I? Come hear me out and then tell me that.
All right, I'll come hear you out. As soon as I dry my feet and rustle up a change of socks. I didn't get to hear Sachs out. To achieve that, I'd first have to perfect a way of communicating with the dead. I left Oscar Sachs as I found him, sprawled backwards over a writer's desk, a knife standing vertically in his Adam's apple. I left him as is, so Lieutenant Trav Rogers wouldn't howl to heaven and the DA that I'd once more tampered with a corpse. Grayson drooled with joy supreme over the recovered manuscript.
This is a load off my mind, Craig. A big load.
But it sounds nothing. Who stole it and why? And why was Sachs murdered between the time he phoned me and the time I got to his flat? I'll show you the manuscript, Grayson, and then I've got a question. Here. Examine it and then tell me. Is this the same manuscript that was stolen?
The same? Why, sure it is. The Cry of the Hyena by Eric Trent.
Examine the manuscript, not just the title page. Study a few sample pages.
Yeah. It's the same.
You'll swear to that?
On a stack? No. No, I won't swear.
You've detected something? Some changes?
Yes. I think yes. For one thing, this copy is cleaner. The edges of the pages aren't so ragged from handling.
As you remember them to have been.
Yes, even the title page looks altered now. I remember a burn here in the upper right corner near the author's name. A burn like from an accidental cigarette ash.
I'm convinced. This isn't the copy that was stolen.
But what can it mean?
I aim to find out. Grayson.
Yes?
Phone Eric Trent. Get him to come here to your office on some pretext.
But why?
So I can have the run of his studio without Trent being the wiser or being present. Eric Trent had all the accumulated junk of a guy with a passion for changing climates. Souvenirs from Bombay, the Dutch Indies, Labrador. Souvenirs in brass, carved ivory, porcelain. And in the bottom bureau drawer, a manuscript. The Cry of the Hyena, with a cigarette burn on the title page. Eric Trent had stolen his own manuscript. I had the evidence in hand, but keeping it wasn't going to be so simple. A lady was against it. A lady healed with a gun twice the size of her dainty, lotioned hand. Miss Judy Joy.
Yes, Mr. Craig. Miss Judy Joy.
Through the convenient connecting door?
I heard noises in here, and I made it just in time to catch a burglar. Drop that manuscript.
You charm me into it. Want a word of advice, beautiful?
No.
I thought you would. Ring off Eric Trent as fast as you can flick your glamorous eyebrows.
You're crazy.
Being true to Trent's an awful waste of war paint now.
What are you trying to tell me?
That Trent's value on the hoof has just been slashed by about $50,000.
He won't get the money?
Neither will you get the money.
You're a liar.
The Dutch uncle. I'd hate to see you dragging your gorgeous chassis up the river Sundays, visiting ye author in the big house.
Pour me a drink.
Still making with the gun?
Aimed at your head while we wait for Eric. It's stuffed on that coffee table there. The soda bottle's right alongside it.
Okay, I'll play bartender. Say when.
When?
How much soda?
Just a squirt. That's enough.
Spot more, huh? Just enough to dampen your spirits?
No, but you're blinding me.
Had enough?
But she's no good. Roll down here.
We held an all-night session. Me, Lieutenant Trav Rogers, and Grayson, comparing the two manuscripts page for page. It was early dawn before I found a discrepancy between the two versions.
You found something, Craig?
Yes, Trav. A Cora Lane disappeared from the substituted version.
Who's Cora Lane?
Tell him, Grayson.
Cora Lane is a character who appears early in the novel. A woman the hero meets and falls in love with.
She's in version one. She's out of version two.
Now, why would the author go to all the trouble he did, submitting a manuscript and then stealing it back just to write a character out of the book?
Because the name Cora Lane means something. Something he didn't want found out.
Means what?
Cora Lane was a character, say, drawn from real life. She's a real name, a real person somewhere.
Excuse me, Mr. Craig. They're saying that Trent only realized it when it was almost too late to make the change.
One thing's pretty clear to me, Grayson. Eric Trent didn't write the book. Somebody else did.
Who would you say did write the book, Craig?
The hero of the story is my guess. Stanley Fields. Only that name is probably an invention, or Eric Trent would have changed it. It figures. The book is an autobiographic work. A man's true personal history disguised as fiction.
The personal history of someone Trent stole the manuscript from.
Someone now dead, or Trent would never have dared to try for the big prize. Trav?
Yes?
Arrest Eric Trent. Book him for the murder of Oscar Sachs.
You're sure?
Sachs tumbled to some of the truth, and Trent shut him up. Trent was also behind the Mike Kelsey red herring. That was a trick to throw dust in our eyes. Arrest Trent, Lieutenant. And when that little chore's over, check police files and directories for a Cora Lane. Go to it, Trav. On this one, I'm making you a gift to the headlines.
Ladies and gentlemen, when a great reporter wants to get the inside story of a great new car, he gives it a thorough test run. That's exactly what John Daly did with the new Pontiac. Here he is to tell you some of the outstanding facts of the new 1952 Pontiac and its spectacular dual-range performance.
This is John Daly to tell you about a great advancement in automobile performance, the great new 1952 Pontiac with spectacular new dual-range performance. A number of factors contribute to this sensational new kind of driving. Pontiac has combined a powerful high-compression engine, new dual-range hydromatic drive, and high-performance economy axle into an amazing powertrain that gives you tailor-made performance. At the touch of a finger, you can have tremendous acceleration and get up and go for any occasion. With equal ease, you can choose a different type of performance, quiet, economical cruising for the open road. Drive the new 1952 Pontiac with dual-range performance on display at your Pontiac dealer now. It's spectacular new proof that dollar for dollar you can't beat a Pontiac.
The great new 1952 Pontiac with dual range performance is on display now at your nearest Pontiac dealer. See it. Drive it as soon as you can. And now, back to Barry Craig.
It took 2 days for Trav to get back to me. When he did, he had a lady with him. A gray lady with haunted eyes.
This is Cora Lane, Craig. Cora Lane, Barry Craig.
Mr. Craig.
How do you do? How did you find her, Trav?
Police files. The name of Cora Lane appeared on an old record card. She reported her husband missing some years back.
Stanley, my husband. He left one morning and never returned. I was frightened. I imagined him injured, a traffic victim. I didn't know then that my husband had planned to just disappear. That he couldn't live in my world. That he had so much wanderlust.
Her husband was the Stanley in the book. The author of it, as you theorize, Craig.
Your husband was a writer?
Yes. A writer all through him. Foolish, wild, irresponsible, and wonderful, too. Is he dead?
Tell her, child.
Yes, he's dead.
Oh.
According to Eric Trent's confession, your husband died of a tropical disease somewhere in the Pacific. Eric Trent was a drifter your late husband had taken up with. An odd thing, Craig.
What odd thing?
I offered you one of two cases the other day.
Why bring that up now?
You took one, but you solved both.
What?
Cora Lane is the maiden name of Mrs. Stanley Talbot. Mrs. Cora Talbot.
Not the $20 a day in expenses deal I passed up.
Yes. As it turned out, you found her missing husband.
A gray lady, Trav, and all-around loser.
Her life hasn't been good.
Her life needs fixing. Mrs. Talbot?
Yes, Mr. Craig.
We're taking a ride, you and me.
A ride?
Cross town. You've been poor, but now you're rich. That book of your husband's, The Cry of the Hyena, there's $50,000 coming to you, and I'm going to stand over Grayson while he makes out that check. Good night, folks. See you next week.
You have been listening to William Gargan in another exciting transcribed mystery drama from the adventures of Barry Craig, confidential investigator. Tonight's story, The Paper Bullets, was written by John Robert. Next week, it's the strange story of Death and the Purple Cow, about which Barry Craig has this to say.
Next week, I lose a client before I get him. A man dies in a hamburger joint. And a purple cow turns out to be neither a cow nor purple. See you next week, folks.
Featured in the role of Judy was Barbara Weeks. Barry Craig, starring William Gargan, was under the direction of Hyman Brown. This is Don Pardo speaking.
Now enjoy Meredith Wilson's Music Room on NBC.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.